Talk given Friday, 3rd of August, 1973. You know how throughout the 45 years of his ministry, the Buddha used to have visitors coming along to inquire the way to nirvana, the meaning of the holy life, to inquire how they should approach certain problems, certain situations, questions of doctrine, and so on. And according to who the questioner was, the Buddha would start his answer in the appropriate way. Time and again, he started with what was called a graduated or a progressive talk. He spoke about what we would call charity, giving, dana. He spoke about dana. He spoke about moral habit, as it is translated. And fairly well, it has its own significance. Moral habit, sila, what we commonly call the basic moralities. He talked about heaven, the idea being that he who lived the good life according to the ordinary socio-religious code of life would experience heaven, the happy born, as it is called, or the happy state, as the consequence of such living. And in the Pali texts, it's generally said that after dying, after the breakup of the body, that is how it is translated. It's true that the word kaya is used, and kaya does mean this physical body. He would experience heaven, but that merit which was accumulated in the course of the life would expend itself in terms of the person's reward in heaven, and then back he comes to earth to continue where he left off, so to say. That was the general idea. Essentially a Hindu idea. Because the Hindus definitely, as a people, I should say not so much Hindu as Brahmanical idea, you see, they, as a people, accepted the idea of a reincarnating entity, the ego. We can use the English word ego. And so the Buddha was talking to such people. And when they came for the first time, he sort of gradually and gently worked up the subject. Now, as you know, they say the Buddha was omniscient. And we have seen through the years some of the real meanings of that word omniscience in connection with the great teachers. Namely, that they completely and fully understood the human mind and heart. And an enlightened one, a perfected holy one, could see what sort of a person that man was the moment he came in. And so, whilst these were the general topics on which he talked, he was well aware all the time of the response inwardly of that person, without that person opening his mouth. And then, when he saw, if he saw, that this person's mind had become uplifted, softened, malleable, receptive, ready to receive the deep truth that the perfected ones had realized, then he spoke, he imparted the four noble truths, as they are called, the Ariya Satyena. The truth of ill and the uprising of ill, dukkha. The truth of the cause of ill. The truth of the extinction of ill. And the truth of the way to that extinction, which meant liberation, which meant the realization of nirvana. The ill state was converted, transmuted into the well state, the state of well-being, in the profoundest and truest sense of the word well-being. Not in the worldly sense, of course, because the world has no idea whatsoever what is meant by well-being for humanity. And if, when he had given the four noble truths, the listener had experienced in that process that extraordinary phenomenon which we call the metanoia, the complete turning inside out from the worldly outlook to the religious outlook on life. If that had happened, then the person said to the Buddha, please give me the ordination and accept me as your disciple, or sometimes it was lay follower, but quite often accept me as your bhikkhu as long as life lasts. And then the Buddha would say, ehi bhikkhu, come bhikkhu, well expounded is the Dhamma, the law, the doctrine, the teaching, the truth. Well expounded is it. Live the holy life in order to make a complete end of all ill. You know, we read these things, we hear them from somebody or other, and we never really penetrate into the immense significance, particularly of those last words. To make a complete end of all ill, not just my ill state or my sorrow or anything like that. I see these words are extremely significant. And then, having accepted, having given that bhikkhu the ordination, and the original ordination right from the beginning of his ministry, which was usually given by him himself, consisted of just those two words, ehi bhikkhu, come bhikkhu. He was invited, he was taken in, into the fold. Underneath are the everlasting arms. There it was. And the discipline started. And how did the discipline start? It started with the simple moralities. In thought and feeling, in word and in deed. To abstain from all slaughter, from all harming, as the Hindus would put it, and which the Buddha himself practiced, although what has come down in the Pali texts is the word slaughter, onslaught on creatures. And you know the rest. Not to take what is not freely given to you. Not to live self-indulgently. To abstain from all untruth. From all rude, harsh, malevolent, gossipy, frivolous, idle chatter. That was the basic thing. And then, as regards the discipline of the body, a factor which has played a very important part, not only in the Buddhist and the Hindu, but in all disciplines. Abstemiousness where food is concerned. One must bear in mind, of course, that for that climate and that country, the one meal a day which he prescribed was adequate. If a perfected holy one were to live in colder climates, he would in all probability take two meals a day. It might be better. There, it was all right. But don't forget, the 2 months of the year India experiences considerable cold. Water freezes outside if you leave a basin full of it. 2 months. It's as cold as that. Even then, it was one meal a day. Abstemiousness in food. And then the other aspect was to watch the senses and the functioning of the senses. Now, this was the preliminary discipline. Now, all this discipline is concerned with basically what we call the body. Now, we all have a very short-sighted view as to what the body is. We think we know what we mean by the word body. But if we spend a few minutes in meditation, we will discover how wrong we are. And I would suggest that we do spend a few minutes now in a sort of a discursive meditation, but concentrate attention upon the different points. Let me just repeat what the Buddha said with respect to the discipline of the body, the simple moralities, abstemiousness in food, and to watch the activity of the senses. and all the sense organs are part of the body. So now, just be, let the mind awake to the reality of what we commonly call the body. We know it is made up of a skeleton, muscles, bloodstream, veins, arteries, different organs, the brain, and the nervous system. It's made up of solids, liquids, gases, and certain other elements, like temperature. It has to maintain a fairly constant temperature. It undergoes a perpetual activity, the metabolic process. There is constant breathing, constant circulation of the blood. The heartbeat. And there is the constant activity of the brain and the nervous system. All this goes on. There is much more. There is an interchange between what we call our own body and materials from outside. Food and drink and air. Just feel this quite vividly. This is important. See this quite vividly. And if there is interchange from outside, we are not only human bodies, but in an extraordinary way, we are all the elements that compose the world in which we live. To use the old-fashioned terms, earth, the bones are solid, water, there is the liquid element inside us. Blood, lymph, synovial fluid, all sorts of things like that. There is the gaseous element inside us. Air. And these elements make up all bodies. Whilst the particular pattern of body which goes by our name, our own name, is a pattern which remains distinct and separate from other such patterns, the fact is that all these patterns are made up of the identical elements. If we talk in modern terms, we have the common gases that we know, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and so forth, the common elements like carbon, sulfur, phosphorus, the non-metals, as they are called. We have metallic elements, iron, copper, manganese, sodium, potassium, and so forth. And they are common to all human bodies and all animal bodies throughout the planet. Or most animal bodies, anyway. Throughout the planet. And there is this interchange. Some of it is very obvious, and a good bit of it is far from obvious, but it is there if we look into it. What then is my body? Does the word my have a totally separative significance? Surely not. We must awake to the relationship between all bodies. We meet on this planet when we are awake as bodies, don't we? First and foremost. So let us be well aware of that basic fundamental fact that we meet as bodies. And it is the body that speaks to the other person, converses with the other person. Occasionally it's a monologue by one person to the other. But in the normal way, there is a conversation. We use our senses to see the person or persons, to hear them talk, and so on. And in this interplay, this separateness, which is rather deep-seated in us about our own body, this separateness of necessity crumbles down. The barriers must necessarily be removed. But now, when we talk, when we use our senses, there is the activity of the brain, isn't there? And the nervous system. A mighty electrochemical process goes on. Continuously goes on. And communication takes place in terms of these ordinarily non-material energies. But that's all part of the body, is it not? And the life of the body. And words and communication through looks or touch or whatever it may be, that is also surely not exactly solid or liquid or gaseous. The whole aspect of psyche comes into it, doesn't it? Now just let's sort of be sensitive to that very vividly. We are psychophysical organisms, as we call ourselves, in complete interrelationship with each other, whether we are conscious of it or not. But as we become sensitive and conscious to this interrelationship, the term my body begins to mean the one and only total body, does it not? Which, as we see, includes what we call psyche. This separation between body and mind is a false separation. It is a one reality, a universe. And this one body, the universe, the great macrocosm, is embodied in each one of us, the microcosm. That is the mystery and the marvel of existence. But we are not awake to that. We are not aware of it. Which means that what we call our own body, our own psyche, is not disciplined. Which means it has not learned the truth. And when the truth is truly learned, one has become that truth. That truth is second nature. Consider this for a moment or two in connection with life in our modern world, especially the terribly pressurized life in the cities, the cruel, stupid necessity to earn a living under such incredible strain and pressure all the time. Something which tends to disrupt, to kill us. And we do that in order to make a living. And we are compelled to do it in order to make a living, because the world's state is like that. Let us be quite sensitive to it, and at the same time, let the intellect be cool and poised see the fact that that is so, that there is no escape from it, no possibility of running away. Wherein then could salvation lie? Might it lie, perhaps, in this intensity of awareness of one body, the total body which is the whole world, the one universe? Our difficulty is to be sufficiently intensely aware of it. This is where the problem comes, and no one can help us. Even if our intellect says yes to it, acknowledges yes that the idea is correct, it is still only an idea. It isn't a fact which is sensitively and intensely felt by our whole being and has become second nature. But something like this is the truth of the body. Now we'll spend a couple of minutes quite quietly, silently, just feel this very intensely, sensitively, but remaining poised. Not the intensity and sensitivity which is an upset, an eruption of feeling, but a very, very powerful feeling which is steady. Just let's see if we can spend 2 or 3 minutes that way. Now, if we have been really intensely sensitive and also intellectually calm and poised, we might have felt that inner stillness and poise which enables us to look and hear the noise, the bustle, the violence, the turmoil of the world. First, with deep compassion, and next to absorb all that without any special discomfort. This is the extraordinary part of the story. But mind you, both elements must be there. The warm, intense feeling and the cool, steady intellect. Now this absorption, this power of absorption into ourselves, into ourselves the microcosm of the disturbance in the macrocosm, and of course in the ordinary way in our daily life, disturbance in our own self. We absorb it all. And if we absorb it in this way, which I believe is not a wrong way, then there is released from within ourselves a curious power which transforms the organism. One's own whole psychophysical organism. You see, it's a little bit like this. If a surgeon has to perform an operation which requires great steadiness and skill, a difficult operation, a serious operation, what would happen if he were to get excited and his hand were to begin to shake and so on? The operation is not likely to be a success, and perhaps the patient is not likely to survive, leave alone recover. It is a little bit like that. This is a skilled operation. This is skill in action, which is yoga, which is part of the holy life. You know how the Buddha and his great arahats always emphasize this aspect of skill, kusala kamma, skill in action, skill in speech, skill in thought. So if this skill can be released within us, in this way, or maybe other ways also, then we are surely realizing those wonderful words of the Buddha: make a complete end of all ill. And this is only one aspect of it. We start with what we commonly call the body, and we realize that the body means in actual fact the totality. Similarly, the word mind means in actual fact the totality. If this sense of totality is there, then I am truly man, truly human. Because remember what I said a few moments ago, there is released first compassion and then this skillful absorption of what takes place. Compassion, which has nothing to do with just an emotional surge. It is a great power, a titanic energy, which has to be handled with skill. We now come to a very, very important point. With the vast majority of human beings the world over, the body dominates us. It has its cravings, its impulses, its whims, its fancies. It sends out this tremendous force which brings about self-indulgence. That is the nature of the body. We, for our part, in fulfilling all these demands of the body, satisfy our own vanities too. Take very careful note of this. And our own egoism. And we are bound, we are prisoners of this vanity and egoism. The body is responsible because it is what it is, especially through its animal origin. The body is responsible for all this. So the mind in us tends to be suppressed. It's not allowed to grow freely, to flower out. As I have said so often in the past, the intellect is the slave of desire. But the source of desire, basically, is the body. The electrochemical process of the body, particularly. Note how we care for the body. Is not a great part of our caring for the body an expression of vanity, of egoity, drawing things unto ourselves for the pleasure of the body, for the pleasures of the body? We care for the body dominated by Trishna, the Pali Tanha, Sanskrit Trishna, the thirst for sentient existence, for sensational excitement, in other words, and for clinging to the continuation of this sort of life, and the prevention of the emergence into the truly human life. That is how we care for the body. Now look, don't we see the world over the extraordinary stupidity characterizing the way in which people live? Their food, their drink, their clothes, their activities, their everything. Vain, egocentric, cruel, useless. The bulk of it is unnecessary. This is a very serious matter. We, if we are really concerned, if we are really serious and sincere with regard to religion, to living the holy life, we have to learn to care for the body in the right way, free of Trishna, free of the clinging to the life and the life process of the body as it is at present, and free of this insensate, completely lunatic pursuit of sensational excitements. Is not the bulk of the horror of the world the terrible things that happen day after day. Murder, theft, rape, accidents, as we call them. Driving cars madly or foolishly so that there's death and destruction spread around. And I'm just giving one instance out of literally scores of such things that happen every day of our lives in the world. Indulgence of the body, no sense of true care for the body. This will appeal specially to you because in England we are very fond of gardens. We are quite a remarkable nation where our gardens are concerned. All right. What do you do when you plant a seed? If you are a good gardener and know how to tend it, what is the underlying principle? You let it grow sweetly, naturally, and come to flower. That is what we have to do with our own bodies. And in order to do that, we have to understand the purpose of the body. We can't begin to have any conception of its right use and all the rest of it and tending it in the right way unless we understand the purpose of this body. Now, we have to be very careful. This is where we are going to be different. Or at least we are going to try to be different from what the world has been doing for millennia. The body is the whole thing. The body is physical. The word physical from the Greek physis, nature, means the body is the natural thing. And nature is totality. We are not a body to which has been plastered on somewhere a soul and some mysterious divine spirit or something. We are the whole thing. Use the word body because we can't. If we talk, language is restricted to separate things. This is the difficulty with language. Every word means something limited, finite, particular, mortal, and so forth. It can't include the totality, except the word totality itself, or the word infinite, or absolute, or something. But barring those four or five words, all the other words are limitations. So we must be free of this misconception, this clouded awareness or consciousness of the body and the mind and this, that and the other being separate. It's the whole thing all the time. And the mystery, the macrocosm, is embodied in the microcosm. You are another version of myself. I am another version of you. And each one of us is a unique and a wonderful version of this totality. How could we continue to be so foolish as to be miserable after that? It seems almost impossible, but the impossible happens time and again. Now, something is coming to flower through this particular microcosm called man. Coming to fruition. this extraordinary thing called happiness, which is not pleasure or sensational disturbance. That is an ailment, sensational disturbance. Happiness. There is another thing which is coming to flower. Intelligence. The ability to know to see the truth of whatever we are experiencing at once. And we experience it through our senses and our sense functions. And the sense organs are absolutely part of the body. No one can deny that. Isn't that so? And there is something else. Through this organism, the psychophysical organism, which is you yourself, the microcosm, through this psychophysical organism, transcendence is awaiting free entry and outflow. And we have to cease to obstruct it. Now you see the purpose of the body, the purpose of the mind, the purpose of any word we can use, separative word we can use, but which really implies the totality. Although the word is separative, it implies the totality. So now, if we care for the body without Trishna, the clinging to sentient existence, and the passionate grasping after all those things that produce sensational excitement and disturbance, then we shall know how to care for the body. There are factors against us, of course. Our animal heritage, as we all know. The law of the animal is the law of survival. Personal survival, if necessary, at the expense of the environment, of the other animal, of the climate, of whatever it may be. But the law of this new thing which is bursting forth through this particular animal called man, the law is not personal survival at the expense of totality. There is no question of personal survival involved in it at all, in fact. It is only a question of letting transcendence flow in quite freely. You see, if you want to picture it, make a sort of a concrete picture, imagine the two laws of our being, which appear contradictory, functioning like this. The law of the jungle, the law of the animal, is a cone standing on the earth like this, we'll say. And the law of the spirit is an inverted cone. And the two meet there. And when we can so live that we are centered where they meet in harmony, then the animal in us and God in us are an identity. Can we care for the body that way? If we care for the body that way, then our whole behavior pattern should express that sort of care. But we care for the body only in this somewhat piggish way. Don't we? Care for the body humanly. And the body will indeed be, will indeed show the face of divinity itself. Its happiness, its intelligence, and its extraordinary, sublime peace and stability. Now there's just one other point we must bear in mind here. That in all this, which is concerned with holy living, because it is mind which is trying to flower out in us essentially and distinguishes us from the other creations on the planet, the living of the holy life has the discipline of the mind as its central feature. We can't get away from that. The use of the physical senses, the use of the physical body itself, as we call it, all implies and necessitates the activity of the mind. When I'm looking at something, if my mind, if my attention is absorbed in something quite different, although all the rays of light are entering my eyes and making their impress here, I haven't seen it at all. Isn't that so? We know that from our own personal experience. Now just one other thing I'd like to say. I suggested this business of the two inverted cones, and they meet. Now just think of the body itself. All the impulses that come to us, say the sense of sight, the activity of the sense of sight, produces an extraordinary flashing electrical activity throughout the brain. It makes its impress there, and afterwards there is this peculiar psychical act of saying, I see a flower or a sunset or a house or my friend or my whatever it is. You see? That is a psychical act. That statement. This which happens here in the brain is this marvelous flashing. That's all. Electrical vibrations. But this brain, right from the days of the Rig Veda, is the region which is called Vyoman, heaven. Heaven. And the flashing in the brain is the light of heaven, this electrical flashing. What is it that clouds that light of heaven and dims it and so forth? My evil thought and feeling, speech and physical action, my daily action, my behavior.